with some woman in a month or two. Her name might have been Debbie or Diana, something like that.
Dolores. Was it Dolores McGowan?
He was looking at me with new eyes, and all at once I wished we'd had this part of our conversation to start with. It would have gone a long way toward establishing my credibility.
It might have been.
He shook his head.
Mona always thought I had eyes for that woman, God knows why.
She said something about rubbing sheep dip into her hands?
Lanolin, he said. For her swollen joints. I'll be damned.
There was one other thing, too, about how you always missed the back loop on your pants. I think she said, who will do that now?
My God, he said softly. Oh, my God. Jamie.
Oh, and she kissed you on the cheek. It was just a little kiss, and years ago, but that sealed the deal. Because he also wanted to believe, I guess. If not in everything, in her. In that kiss. That she had been there. I left while I was ahead. 40. I kept an eye out for Terrio on my way home. That was second nature to me by then, but didn't see him. Which was great, but I'd given up hoping that he was gone for good. He was a bad penny, and he'd turn up. I only hoped I would be ready for him when he did. That night, I got an email from Professor Burkett.
I did a little research with interesting results, it said. I thought you also might be interested.
There were three attachments, all three reviews of Regis Thomas's last book. The professor had highlighted the lines he had found interesting, leaving me to draw my own conclusions, which I did. From the Sunday Times book review,
Regis Thomas's swan song is the usual farrago of sex and swamp-tromping adventure, but the prose is sharper than usual. Here and there one finds glimmers of actual writing.
From The Guardian,
although the long-brooded mystery of Roanoke won't be much of a surprise to readers of the series, who surely saw it coming, Thomas's narrative voice is livelier than one might expect from the previous volumes, where turgid exposition alternated with fervid and sometimes comical sexual encounters.
From The Miami Herald,
the dialogue snaps, the pacing is crisp, and for once the lesbian liaison between Laura Goodhue and Purity Betancourt feels real and touching, rather than like a prurient joke or a stroke fantasy. It's a great wind-up.
I couldn't show those reviews to my mother. They would have raised too many questions. But I was pretty sure she must have seen them herself, and I guessed they had made her as happy as they made me. Not only had she gotten away with it, she had put a shine on Regis Thomas's sadly tarnished reputation. There were many nights in the weeks and months following my first encounter with Kenneth Terrio when I went to bed feeling unhappy and afraid. That night wasn't one of them.
41.
I'm not sure how many times I saw him the rest of that summer, which should tell you something. If it doesn't, here it is in plain English. I was getting used to him. I never would have believed it on the day when I turned around and saw him standing by the trunk of Liz Dutton's car, close enough to touch me. I never would have believed it on the day when the elevator opened and he was in there telling me my mother had cancer and grinning like it was the happiest news ever. But familiarity breeds contempt, so they say, and in this case, the saying was true. It no doubt helped that he never did show up in my closet or under my bed, which would have been worse because when I was little, I was sure that was where the monster was waiting to grab a dangling foot or arm. That summer, I read Dracula. Okay, not the actual book, but a kick-ass graphic novel I bought at Forbidden Planet, and in it, Van Helsing said that a vampire couldn't come in unless you invited him. If it was true of vampires, it stood to reason, at least to 13-year-old me it did, that it was true of other supernatural beings, like the one inside of Terrio, keeping him from disappearing after a few days like all the other dead people. I checked Wikipedia to see if Mr. Stoker just made that up, but he didn't. It was in lots of the vampire legends. Now, later, I can see it makes symbolic sense. If we have free will, then you have to invite evil in. Here's something else. He had mostly stopped crooking that finger at me. For most of that summer, he just stood at a distance, staring. The only time I did see him beckoning was kind of funny. If, that is, you can say anything about that undead motherfucker was funny. Mom got us tickets to see the Mets play the Tigers on the last Sunday in August. The Mets lost big, but I didn't care because Mom bagged a pair of awesome seats from one of her publisher friends. Contrary to popular belief, literary agents do have friends. They were on the third base side, just two rows up from the field. It was during the seventh inning stretch, while the Mets were still keeping it close, that I saw Terrio. I looked around for the hot dog man, and when I looked back, my pal Thumper was standing near the third base coach's box. Same khaki pants, same shirt with blood all down the left side and spattering the suicide note. Head blown open like somebody lit off a cherry bomb in there. Grinning. And, yes, beckoning. The Tigers' infield was throwing the ball around, and just after I saw Terrio, a chuck from the shortstop to the third baseman went way wild. The crowd whooped and jeered, the usual stuff.
Nice throw, Busher.
My grandma could do better than that.
But I just sat there with my hands clamped so tight the nails were biting into my palms. The shortstop hadn't seen Terrio. He would have run into the outfield screaming if he had, but he felt him. I know he did. And here's something else. The third base coach went to retrieve the ball, then backed off and let it roll into the dugout. Shagging it would have brought him right next to the thing only I could see. Did the guy feel a cold spot, like in a ghost movie? I don't think so. I think he felt, just for a second or two, that the world was trembling around him, vibrating, like a guitar string. I have reasons to think that. Mom said, "Okay, Jamie, you're not getting sunstroke on me, are you?" "I'm fine," I said, and clenched hands or not, I mostly was. "Do you see the hot dog man?" She craned around and waved to the nearest vendor, which gave me a chance to give Kenneth Terrio the finger. His grin turned into a snarl that showed all his teeth. Then he walked into the visitor's dugout, where the players who weren't on the field no doubt shuffled around on the bench to give him room without any idea why they were doing it. I sat back with a smile. I wasn't ready to think that I'd vanquished him, not with a cross or holy water, but by flipping him the bird. But the idea did kind of tiptoe in. People started to leave in the top of the ninth after the Tigers scored 7 and put the game out of reach. Mom asked me if I wanted to stay and watch the Mr. Met dash, and I shook my head. The dash was strictly for little kids. I had done it once back before Liz, back before that fucker James McKenzie stole our money in his Ponzi scheme, even before the day Mona Burkett told me turkeys weren't green. Back when I was a little kid and the world was my oyster. That seemed so long ago. 42. You may be asking yourself a question I never asked myself back then. Why me? Why Jamie Conklin? I have asked myself since, and I don't know. I can only guess. I think it was because I was different, and it, the it inside the shell of Terrio, hated me for it and wanted to hurt me, even destroy me if it could. I think, call me crazy if you want, I offended it somehow. And maybe there was something else. I think, maybe, just maybe, the ritual of Chud had already begun. I think that once it started fucking with me, it couldn't stop. As I said, just guessing here, its reasons might have been something else entirely, as unknowable as it was to me, and as monstrous. As I said, this is a horror story. 43. I was still scared of Terrio, but I no longer thought that I might chicken out if an opportunity came to put Professor Burkett's ritual into practice. I only needed to be ready. for Terrio to get close, in other words, not just be across the street or standing near third base at Citi Field. My chance came on a Saturday in October. I was going down to Grover Park to play touch football with a bunch of kids from my school. Mom left me a note that said she'd stayed up late reading Philippa Stevens' latest opus and was going to sleep in. I was to get my breakfast quietly and no more than half a cup of coffee. I was to have a good time with my friends and not come home with a concussion or a broken arm. I was to be back by 2 at the very latest. She left me lunch money, which I folded carefully into my pocket. There was a P.S.
Would it be a waste of time to ask you to eat something green, even a scrap of lettuce on a hamburger?
Probably, Mom. Probably, I thought as I poured myself a bowl of Cheerios and ate them, quietly. When I left the apartment, Terrio wasn't on my mind. He spent less and less time there, and I used some of the newly available space to think about other things, mostly girls. I was dwelling on Valeria Gomez in particular as I walked down the hall to the elevator. Did Terrio decide to get close that day because he had a kind of window into my head and knew he was far from my thoughts? Sort of a low-grade telepathy? I don't know that either. I pushed the call button, wondering if Valeria would come to the game. It was quite possible because her brother Pablo played. I was deep in a daydream of how I caught a pass, evaded all the would-be touchers, and sped into the end zone with the ball held high. But I still stepped back when the elevator arrived. That had become second nature to me. It was empty. I pushed for the lobby. The elevator went down, and the door opened. It was a short stub of hallway, and then a door locked from the inside, which gave on a little foyer. The door to the outside wasn't locked, so the mailman could come in and put the mail in the boxes. If Terrio had been out there, in the foyer, I couldn't have done what I did, but he wasn't in the foyer. He was inside, at the end of the hall, grinning away like doing so was going to be outlawed the day after tomorrow. He started to say something, maybe one of his bullshit prophecies, and if I'd been thinking of him instead of Valeria, I probably would have either frozen in place or stumbled back into the elevator car, whamming on the door close button for all I was worth. But I was being pissed at him for intruding on my fantasy, and all I remember thinking was what Professor Burkett told me on the day I brought him the casserole. The tongue-biting in the ritual of Chud is only one ceremony before meeting an enemy, he said. There are many. The Maoris do a war cry dance as they face their opponents. Kamikaze pilots toasted each other and photographs of their targets with what they believed was magical sake. In ancient Egypt, members of warring houses struck each other on the forehead before getting out the knives and spears and bows. Sumo wrestlers clap each other on the shoulders. All come down to the same thing. I meet you in combat, where one of us will best the other. In other words, Jamie, don't bother sticking out your tongue. Just grab your demon and hold on for dear life. Instead of freezing or cringing, I bolted thoughtlessly forward with my arms out like I was about to embrace a long-absent friend. I screamed, but I think only in my head because nobody looked out from one of the ground-floor apartments to see what was going on. Terrio's grin, the one that had always showed that lump of dead blood between his teeth and his cheek, disappeared, and I saw an amazing, wonderful thing. He was afraid of me. He cringed back against the door to the foyer, but it opened the other way, and he was pinned. I grabbed him. I can't describe how it went down. I don't think a much more gifted writer than I am could, but I'll do the best I can. Remember what I said about the world trembling or vibrating like a guitar string? That was what it was like on the outside of Terrio and all around him. I could feel it shaking my teeth and jittering my eyeballs. Only there was something else on the inside of Terrio. It was something that was using him as a vessel and keeping him from moving on to wherever dead people go when their connection to our world rots away. It was a very bad thing, and it was yelling at me to let it go, or to let Terrio go. Maybe there was no difference. It was furious with me and scared, but mostly it was surprised. Being grabbed was the last thing it had expected. It struggled and would have gotten away if Terrio hadn't been pinned against the door, I'm sure of that. I was a skinny kid. Terrio was easily 5 inches taller and would have outweighed me by at least 100 pounds if he'd been alive, but he wasn't. The thing inside him was alive, and I was pretty sure it had come in when I was forcing Terrio to answer my questions outside that little store. The vibration got worse. It was coming up through the floor. It was coming down from the ceiling. The overhead light was shaking and throwing liquid shadows. The walls seemed to be crawling first one way, then the other.
"Let me go,"
Terrio said, and even his voice was vibrating. It sounded like when you put waxed paper over a comb and blew on it. His arms flew out to either side, then closed in and clapped me on the back. It immediately became hard to breathe.
"Let me go, and I'll let you go."
"No," I said, and hugged him tighter. This is it, I remember thinking. This is Chud. I'm in mortal combat with a demon right here in the front hall of my New York apartment building.
"I'll strangle the breath out of you."
"You can't," I said, hoping I was right about that. I could still breathe, but they were mighty short breaths. I began to think I could see into Terrio. Maybe it was a hallucination brought on by the vibration and the sense that the world was on the verge of exploding like a delicate wine glass, but I don't think so. It wasn't his guts I was looking at, but a light. It was bright and dark at the same time. It was something from outside the world. It was horrible. How long did we stand there, hugging each other? It could have been 5 hours or only 90 seconds. You could say 5 hours was impossible, someone would have come, but I think, I almost know, that we were outside of time. One thing I can say for sure is that the elevator doors didn't close as they were supposed to 5 seconds or so after the passengers got out. I could see the elevator's reflection over Terrio's shoulder, and the doors stayed open the whole time. At last, it said,
"Let me go, and I'll never come back."
That was an extremely tasty idea, as I'm sure you'll understand, and I might have done it if the professor hadn't prepared me for this as well.
"It will try to bargain," he said. "Don't let it."
And then he told me what to do, probably thinking that the only thing I had to confront was some neurosis or complex or whatever psychological thing you want to call it.
"Not good enough," I said,
and went on hugging. I could see more and more into Terrio and realized he really was a ghost. Probably all dead people are, and I just saw them as solid. The more insubstantial he became, the brighter that dark light, that dead light, shone. I don't have any idea what it was. I only knew I had caught it, and there's an old saying that goes, "He who takes a tiger by the tail dare not let go." The thing inside Terrio was worse than any tiger.
"What do you want?"
Gasping it. There was no breath in him. I surely would have felt it on my cheek and neck if it had been there, but he was gasping just the same. In worse shape than I was, maybe.
"It's not enough for you to stop haunting me."
I took a deep breath and said what Professor Burkett had told me to say, if I was able to engage my nemesis in the ritual of Chud. And even though the world was shivering around me, even though this thing had me in a death grip, it gave me pleasure to say it, great pleasure, warrior's pleasure.
"Now I'll haunt you." "No!"
Its grip tightened. I was squeezed against Terrio, even though Terrio was now nothing but a supernatural hologram.
"Yes!"
Professor Burkett told me to say something else if I got the chance. I later found out it was the amended title of a famous ghost story, which made it very fitting.
"Oh, I'll whistle, and you'll come to me, my lad." "No!"
It struggled. That vile, pulsing light made me feel like puking, but I held on.
"Yes!" I'll haunt you as much as I want, whenever I want. And if you don't agree, I'll hold on to you until you die.
I can't die, but you can.
That was undoubtedly true, but at that moment, I had never felt stronger. Plus, all the time, Terrio was fading, and he was that dead light's toehold in our world. I said nothing, only clutched, and Terrio clutched me. It went on like that. I was getting cold, feet and hands losing sensation, but I held on. I meant to hold on forever, if I had to. I was terrified of the thing that was inside Terrio, but it was trapped. Of course, I was also trapped. That was the nature of the ritual. If I let go, it won. At last, it said,
I agree to your terms.
I loosened my grip, but only a little. Are you lying? A stupid question, you might say, except it wasn't.
I can't!
Sounding slightly petulant.
You know that!
Say it again. Say you agree.
I agree to your terms.
You know that I can haunt you?
I know, but I'm not afraid of you.
Bold words, but as I'd already found out, Terrio could make as many untrue statements as it wanted to. Statements weren't answers to questions, and anybody who has to say they're not afraid is lying. I didn't have to wait until later to learn that. I knew it at 13. Are you afraid of me? I saw that cramped expression on Terrio's face again, as if he was tasting something sour and unpleasant, which was probably how telling the truth felt to the miserable son of a bitch.
Yes. You're not like the others. You see.
Yes. What?
Yes, I'm afraid of you.
Sweet. I let him go. Get out of here, whatever you are, and go to wherever you go. Just remember, if I call you, you come. He whirled around, giving me one final look at the gaping hole in the left side of his head. He grabbed at the doorknob. His hand went through it, and didn't go through it. Both. At the same time, I know, it's crazy, a paradox, but it happened. I saw it. The knob turned, and the door opened. At the same time, the overhead light blew out, and glass tinkled down from the fixture. There were a dozen or so mailboxes in the foyer, and half of them popped open. Terrio gave me one last hateful look over his bloody shoulder, and then he was gone, leaving the front door open. I saw him go down the steps, not so much running as plunging. A guy speeding past on his bike, probably a messenger, lost his balance, fell over, and sprawled in the street, cursing. I knew the dead could impact the living. That was no surprise. I'd seen it, but those impacts had always been little things. Professor Burkett had felt his wife's kiss. Liz had felt Regis Thomas blow on her face, but the things I'd just seen, the light that blew out, the jittery, vibrating doorknob that had turned, the messenger falling off his bike, were on an entirely different level. The thing I'm calling the deadlight almost lost its host while I was holding on, but when I let go, it did more than regain Terrio. It got stronger. That strength must have come from me. But I didn't feel any weaker, like poor Lucy Westenra while Count Dracula was using her as his personal lunch wagon. In fact, I felt better than ever, refreshed, invigorated. It was stronger. So what? I'd owned it, had made it my bitch. For the first time since Liz had picked me up from school that day and taken me hunting for Terrio, I felt good again, like someone who's had a serious illness and is finally on the mend.
44. I got back home around 2:15, a little late, but not where have you been, I was so worried late. I had a long scrape on one arm, and the knee of my pants got torn when one of the high school boys bumped me and I went down hard, but I felt pretty damn fine just the same. Valeria wasn't there, but two of her girlfriends were. One of them said Valeria liked me, and the other one said I should talk to her, maybe sit with her at lunch. God, the possibilities. I let myself in and saw that someone, probably Mr. Provenza, the building super, had closed the mailboxes that had popped open when Terrio left, or, to put it more accurately, when he fled the scene. Mr. Provenza had also cleaned up the broken glass and put a sign in the front of the elevator that said, "Temporarily out of order." That made me remember the day Mom and I came home from school, me clutching my green turkey, and found the elevator at the Palace on Park out of order.
"Fuck this elevator," Mom had said. Then, "You didn't hear that, kiddo."
Old days. I took the stairs and let myself in to find Mom had dragged her home office chair up to the living room window where she was reading and drinking coffee.
"I was just about to call you," she said,
and then, looking down,
"Oh my God, that's a new pair of jeans."
"Sorry," I said. "Maybe you can patch them up."
"I have many skills, but sewing isn't one of them. I'll take them to Mrs. Abelson at Dandy Cleaners. What did you have for lunch?"
"A burger with lettuce and tomato."
"Is that true?"
"I cannot tell a lie," I said, and of course that made me think of Terrio, and I gave a little shiver.
"Let me see your arm. Come over here where I can get a good look."
I came over and displayed my battle scar.
"No need of a Band-Aid, I guess, but you need to put on some Neosporin."
"Okay if I watch ESPN after I do that?"
"It would be if we had electricity. Why do you think I'm reading at the window instead of at my desk?"
"Oh, that must be why the elevator isn't working."
"Your powers of deduction stun me, Holmes."
This was one of my mom's literary jokes. She has dozens of them, maybe hundreds.
"It's just our building. Mr. Provenza says something blew out all the breakers, some kind of power surge. He said he's never seen anything like it. He's going to try to get it fixed by tonight, but I've got an idea we'll be running on candles and flashlights once it gets dark."
Terrio, I thought, but of course it wasn't. It was the deadlight thing that was now inhabiting Terrio. It blew the light fixture. It opened some of the mailboxes and it fried the circuit breakers, for good measure, when it left. I went into the bathroom to get the Neosporin. It was pretty dark in there, so I flipped the light switch. Habit's a bitch, isn't it? I sat on the sofa to spread antibiotic goo on my scrape, looking at the blank TV and wondering how many circuit breakers there were in an apartment building the size of ours and how much power it would take to cook them all. I could whistle for that thing, and if I did, would it come to the lad named Jamie Conklin? That was a lot of power for a kid who wouldn't even be able to get a driver's license for another 3 years. "Mom?"
"What?"
"Do you think I'm old enough to have a girlfriend?"
"No, dear,"
without looking up from her manuscript. "When will I be old enough?"
"How does 25 sound?"
She started laughing, and I laughed with her. Maybe, I thought, when I was 25 or so, I'd summon Terrio and ask him to bring me a glass of water. But on second thought, anything it brought might be poison. Maybe just for shits and giggles, I'd ask it to stand on its Terrio head, do a split, maybe walk on the ceiling. Or I could let it go, tell it to get buzzin', cousin. Of course, I didn't have to wait until I was 25. I could do that any time. Only, I didn't want to. Let it be my prisoner for a while. That nasty, horrible light. Reduced to little more than a firefly in a jar. See how it liked that. The electricity came back on at 10:00, and all was right with the world. 45. On Sunday, Mom proposed a visit to Professor Burkett to see how he was doing and to retrieve the casserole dish.
"Also, we could bring him some croissants from Haber's."
I said that sounded good. She gave him a call, and he said he'd love to see us, so we walked to the bakery and then hailed a cab. My mother refused to use Uber. She said they weren't New York. Taxis were New York. I guess the miracle of healing goes on even when you're old, because Professor Burkitt was down to only one cane and moving pretty well. Not apt to be running in the New York City Marathon again, if he ever had, but he gave Mom a hug at the door, and I wasn't afraid he was going to faceplant when he shook my hand. He gave me a keen look, I gave him a slight nod, and he smiled. We understood each other. Mom bustled around, setting out the croissants and pats of butter and the tiny pots of jam that came with them. We ate in the kitchen with the mid-morning sun slanting in. It was a nice little meal. When we were done, Mom transferred the remains of the casserole, which was most of it, I guess old folks don't eat much, to a Tupperware and washed her dish. She set it to dry and then excused herself to use the bathroom. As soon as she was gone, Professor Burkitt leaned across the table.
What happened?
He was in the foyer when I came out of the elevator yesterday. I didn't think about it, just rushed forward and grabbed him.
He was there. This Terrio, you saw him, felt him.
Still half convinced it was all in my mind, you know. I could see it on his face, and really, who could blame him?
Yeah, but it's not Terrio, not anymore. The thing inside, it's a light. I tried to get away, but I held on. It was scary, but I knew it would be bad for me if I let go. Finally, when it saw that Terrio was fading out, it—
Fading out? What do you mean?
The toilet flushed. Mom wouldn't come back until she'd washed her hands, but that wouldn't take long.
I told it what you told me to say, Professor, that if I whistled, it had to come to me, that it was my turn to haunt it. It agreed. I made it say it out loud, and it did.
My mother came back before he could ask any more questions, but I could see he looked troubled and was still thinking the whole confrontation had been in my mind.
I got that, but I was a little pissed just the same. I mean, he knew stuff about the rings and Mr. Thomas's book.
But looking back on it, I understand. Belief is a high hurdle to get over, and I think it's even higher for smart people. Smart people know a lot, and maybe that makes them think they know everything.
We ought to go, Jamie, Mom said. I've got a manuscript to finish.
You always have a manuscript to finish, I said, which made her laugh because it was true. There were to-read stacks in both the agency office and her home office, and both of them were always piled high.
Before we go, tell the professor what happened in our building yesterday.
She turned to Professor Burkitt.
That was so strange, Marty. Every circuit breaker in the building blew out, all at once.
Mr. Prevenza, he's the super, said there must have been some kind of power surge. He said he'd never seen anything like it. The professor looked startled.
Only your building.
Just ours, she agreed. Come on, Jamie, let's get out of here and let Marty rest.
Going out was an almost exact replay of going in. Professor Burkitt gave me a keen look, and I gave him a slight nod. We understood each other.
46.
That night, I got an email from him sent from his iPad. He was the only person of my acquaintance who ever used a salutation when he sent one, and wrote actual letters instead of stuff like, "How are you?" and "ROFL" and "IMHO."
Dear Jamie, after you and your mother left this morning, I did some research concerning the discovery of the bomb at the Eastport supermarket, a thing I should have done earlier. What I found was interesting. Elizabeth Dutton did not figure prominently in any of the news stories. The bomb squad got most of the credit, especially the dogs because people love dogs. I believe the mayor may have actually given a dog a medal. She was mentioned only as a detective who received a tip from an old source. I found it peculiar that she did not take part in the press conference following the successful defusing of the bomb, and that she did not receive an official commendation. She has, however, managed to keep her job. That may have been all the reward she wanted, and all her superiors felt she deserved. Given my research on this matter, plus the strange power outage in your building at the time of your confrontation with Terrio, plus other matters of which you have made me aware, I find myself unable to disbelieve the things you've told me. I must add a word of caution.
I did not care for the look of confidence on your face when you said it was your turn to haunt it, or that you could whistle for it and it would come. Perhaps it would, but I urge you not to do it. Tightrope walkers sometimes fall. Lion tamers can be mauled by cats they believe to be completely tamed. Under certain conditions, even the best dog may turn and bite his master. My advice to you, Jamie, is to leave this thing alone. With every good wish from your friend, Professor Martin Birkett. Marty. P.S. I am very curious to know the exact details of your extraordinary experience. If you can come and see me, I would listen with great interest. I am assuming you still do not want to burden your mother with the story, since it seems that matters have come to a successful conclusion. I wrote back right away. My response was much shorter, but I made sure to compose it as he had, like a snail mail letter. Dear Professor Birkett, I'd be glad to do that, but I can't until Wednesday because of a trip to the Metropolitan Museum of Art on Monday and intramural volleyball, boys against the girls, on Tuesday. If Wednesday is okay, I will come after school, like around 3:30, but I can only stay for an hour or so. I'll tell my mother I just wanted to visit you, which is true. Yours in friendship, James Conklin. Professor Birkett must have had his iPad in his lap. I could picture him sitting in his living room with all its framed pictures of old times, because he replied at once. Dear Jamie, Wednesday will be fine. I will look for you at 3:30 and will supply raisin cookies. Would you prefer tea or a soft drink to go with them? Yours, Marty Birkett. I didn't bother making my reply look like a snail mail letter, just typed, I wouldn't mind a cup of coffee. After thinking about that, I added, it's okay with my mom, which wasn't a total lie, and he actually sent me an emoji in return. A thumbs up. I thought that was pretty hip. I did speak with Professor Birkett again, but there were no drinks or snacks. He no longer used those things because he was dead. 47. On Tuesday morning, I got another email from him. My mother got the same one, and so did several other people. Dear friends and associates, I have received some bad news. David Robertson, old friend, colleague, and former department head, suffered a stroke at his retirement home on Siesta Key in Florida last evening and is now in Sarasota Memorial Hospital. He is not expected to live or even to regain consciousness, but I have known Dave and his lovely wife Marie for over 40 years, and must make the trip little as I want to, if only to offer comfort to his wife and attend the funeral, should it come to that. I will reschedule such appointments as I have upon my return. I will be in residence at Bentley's Boutique Hotel, such a name, in Osprey for the length of my stay, and you can reach me there, but the best way to get in touch with me is still email. As most of you know, I do not carry a personal phone. I apologize for any inconvenience. Sincerely yours, Professor Martin F. Birkett, Emeritus. He's old school, I said to Mom as we ate our breakfast, grapefruit and yogurt for her, Cheerios for me. She nodded. He is, and there aren't many of his kind left. To rush to the bedside of a dying friend at his age? She shook her head. Remarkable. Admirable. And that email. Professor Birkett doesn't write emails, I said. He writes letters. True, but not what I was thinking of. Really, how many appointments and scheduled visitors do you think he has at his age? Well, there was one, I thought, but didn't say. 48. I don't know if the professor's old friend died or not. I only know that the professor did. He had a heart attack on the flight and was dead in his seat when the plane landed. He had another old friend who was his lawyer. He was one of the recipients of the professor's final email, and he was the one who got the call. He took charge of getting the body shipped back, but it was my mom who stepped up after that. She closed the office and made the funeral arrangements. I was proud of her for that. She cried and was sad because she had lost a friend, I was just as sad because I'd made her friend my own. With Liz gone, he'd been my only grown-up friend. The funeral was at the Presbyterian Church on Park Avenue, same as Mona Burkett's had been 7 years before. My mother was outraged that the daughter, the one on the West Coast, didn't attend. Later, just out of curiosity, I called up that last email from Professor Burkett and saw she hadn't been one of the recipients. The only three women who had gotten it were my mother, Mrs. Richards, an old lady he was friendly with on the fourth floor of the Palace on Park, and Dolores McGowan, the woman Mrs. Burkett had mistakenly predicted her widower husband would soon be asking out to lunch. I looked for the professor at the church service, thinking that if his wife had attended hers, he might attend his. He wasn't there, but this time we went to the cemetery service as well, and I saw him, sitting on a gravestone 20 or 30 feet away from the mourners, but close enough to hear what was being said. During the prayer, I raised my hand and gave him a discreet wave. Not much more than a twiddle of the fingers, but he saw it and smiled and waved back. He was a regular dead person, not a monster, like Kenneth Terrio. And I started to cry. My mother put her arm around me. 49. That was on a Monday, so I never did get to the Metropolitan Museum of Art with my class. I got the day off school to go to the funeral, and when we got back, I told my mother I wanted to go for a walk, that I needed to think. "That's fine, if you're okay. Are you okay, Jamie?" "Yes," I said, and gave her a smile to prove it. "Be back by 5, or I'll worry." "I will be." I got as far as the door before she asked me the question I'd been waiting for. "Was he there?" I'd thought about lying, like maybe that would spare her feelings, but maybe it would make her feel better instead. "Yes, not at the church, but at the cemetery."
How did he look?"
I told her he looked okay, and that was the truth. They're always wearing the clothes they had on when they died, which in Professor Burkett's case was a brown suit that was a little too big for him, but still looked quite cool, in my humble opinion. I liked that he'd put on a suit for the plane ride, because it was another part of being old school. And he didn't have his cane, possibly because he wasn't holding it when he died, or because he dropped it when the heart attack struck.
"Jamie, could your old mom have a hug before you go out on your walk?"
I hugged her a long time. 50. I walked to the Palace on Park, much older and taller than the little boy who had come home from school one fall day, holding his mother's hand on one side and his green turkey on the other. Older, taller, and maybe even wiser, but still that same person. We change, and we don't. I can't explain it. It's a mystery. I couldn't go inside the building, I had no key, but I didn't need to because Professor Burkett was sitting on the steps in his brown traveling suit. I sat down beside him. An old lady walked by with a little fluffy dog. The dog looked at the professor, the old lady didn't. "Hello, Professor."
"Hello, Jamie."
It had been 5 days since he died on the airplane, and his voice was doing that fade-out thing they do, as if he was talking to me from far away and getting farther all the time. And while he seemed as kind as ever, he also seemed sort of, I don't know, disconnected. Most of them do. Even Mrs. Burkett was that way, although she was chattier than most, and some don't talk at all unless you ask them a question. Because they are watching the parade instead of marching in it. That's close, but still not quite right. It's as if they've got other, more important things on their minds. And for the first time, I realized that my voice must be fading for him as well. The whole world must be fading. "Are you okay?"
"Yes."
"Did it hurt? The heart attack?"
"Yes, but it was over soon."
He was looking out at the street, not at me, as if storing it up. "Is there anything you need me to do?"
"Only one thing. Never call for Terrio, because Terrio is gone. What would come is the thing that possessed him. I believe that in literature that sort of entity is called a walk-in.
I won't, I promise. Professor, why could it even possess him in the first place? Because Terrio was evil to start with, is that why?
I don't know, but it seems likely.
Do you still want to hear what happened when I grabbed him? I thought of his email. The details.
No. This disappointed me, but didn't surprise me. Dead people lose interest in the lives of the living. Just remember what I've told you.
I will, don't worry. A faint shadow of irritation came into his voice.
I wonder. You were incredibly brave, but you were also incredibly lucky. You don't understand because you're just a child, but take my word for it. That thing is from outside the universe. There are horrors there that no man can conceive of. If you truck with it, you risk death or madness or the destruction of your very soul.
I'd never heard anyone talk about trucking with something. I suppose it was another of the professor's old school words, like icebox for refrigerator, but I got the gist. And if he meant to scare me, he had succeeded. The destruction of my soul? Jesus.
I won't, I said. I really won't.
He didn't reply, just looked out at the street with his hands on his knees. I'll miss you, Professor.
All right.
His voice was growing fainter all the time. Pretty soon I wouldn't be able to hear him at all. I'd only be able to see his lips moving. Can I ask you one more thing?
Stupid question. When you ask, they have to answer, although you might not always like what you hear. Yes.
I ask my question. 51. When I got home, my mother was making salmon the way we like it, wrapped in wet paper towels and steamed in the microwave. You wouldn't think anything so easy could taste good, but it does.
Right on time, she said. There's a bag salad Caesar. Will you put it together for me?
Okay. I got it out of the fridge, the ice box, and opened the bag.
Don't forget to wash it. The bag says it's already been washed, but I never trust that. Use the colander.
I got the colander, dumped in the lettuce, and used the sprayer. I went to our old building, I said. I wasn't looking at her. I was concentrating on my job.
I kind of thought you might. Was he there?
Yes. I asked him why his daughter never came to visit him and didn't even come to the funeral. I turned off the water. She's in a mental institution, Mom. He says she'll be there for the rest of her life. She killed her baby and then tried to kill herself. My mother was getting ready to put the salmon in the microwave, but she set it on the counter instead and plopped down on one of the stools.
Oh my God. Mona told me she was an assistant in a biology lab at Caltech. She seemed so proud.
Professor Burkett said she's catatonic. Yeah, that. My mother was looking down at our dinner-to-be, the salmon's pink flesh kind of glimmering through its shroud of paper towels. She seemed to be thinking very deeply. Then the vertical line between her eyebrows smoothed out.
So now we know something we probably shouldn't. It's done and can't be undone. Everybody has secrets, Jamie. You'll find that out for yourself in time.
Thanks to Liz and Kenneth Terrio, I had found that out already. And I found out my mother's secret, too. Later. 52. Kenneth Terrio disappeared from the news, replaced by other monsters. And because he had stopped haunting me, he also disappeared from the forefront of my mind. As that fall chilled into winter, I still had a tendency to step back from the elevator doors when they opened, but by the time I turned 14, that little tick had disappeared. I saw other dead people from time to time, and there were probably some I missed since they looked like normal people unless they died of injuries or you got right up close. I'll tell you about one, although it has nothing to do with my main story.
He was a little boy, no older than I had been on the day I saw Mrs. Burkitt. He was standing on the divider that runs down the middle of Park Avenue, dressed in red shorts and a Star Wars t-shirt. He was paper pale. His lips were blue. And I think he was trying to cry, although there were no tears. Because he looked vaguely familiar, I crossed the downtown side of Park and asked him what was wrong. You know, besides being dead.
I can't find my way home.
Do you know your address?
I live at 490 2nd Avenue, apartment 16B.
He ran it off like a recording. Okay, I said, that's pretty close. Come on, kid, I'll take you there. It was a building called Kipps Bay Court. When we got there, he just sat down on the curb. He wasn't crying anymore, and he was starting to get that drifting away look they all get. I didn't like to leave him there, but I didn't know what else to do. Before I left, I asked him his name, and he said it was Richard Scarlatti. Then I knew where I'd seen him. His picture was on New York One. Some big boys drowned him in Swan Lake, which is in Central Park. Those boys all cried like blue fuck and said they'd only been goofing around. Maybe that was true. Maybe I'll understand all that stuff later, but actually, I don't think so. 53. By then, we were doing well enough that I could have gone to a private school. My mother showed me brochures from the Dalton School and the Friends Seminary, but I chose to stay public and go to Roosevelt, home of the Mustangs. It was okay. Those were good years for Mom and me. She landed a super big client who wrote stories about trolls and wood elves and noble guys who went on quests. I landed a girlfriend, sort of. Mary Lou Stein was kind of a goth intellectual in spite of her girl-next-door name and a huge cinephile. We went to the Angelica just about once every week and sat in the back row reading subtitles. One day shortly after my birthday, I'd reached the grand old age of 15, Mom texted me and asked if I could drop by the agency office after school instead of going straight home. Not a huge deal, she said, just some news she wanted to pass on in person. When I got there, she poured me a cup of coffee, unusual but not unheard of by then, and asked if I remembered Jesus Hernandez. I told her I did. He had been Liz's partner for a couple of years, and a couple of times Mom brought me along when she and Liz had meals with Detective Hernandez and his wife. That was quite a while ago, but it's hard to forget a 6'6" detective named Jesus, even if it is pronounced Jesus. I loved his dreads, I said. They were cool. He called to tell me Liz lost her job. Mom and Liz had been quits a long time by then, but Mom still looked sad. She finally got caught transporting drugs. Quite a lot of heroin, Jesus says. It hit me hard. Liz hadn't been good for my mother after a while, and she sure as shit hadn't been good for me, but it was still a bummer. I remembered her tickling me until I almost wet my pants and sitting between her and Mom on the couch, all of us making stupid cracks about the shows, and the time she took me to the Bronx Zoo and bought me a cone of cotton candy bigger than my head. Also, don't forget that she saved 50 or maybe even 100 lives that would have been lost if Thumper's last bomb had gone off. Her motivation might have been good or bad, but those lives were saved either way. That overheard phrase from their last argument came to me. Serious weight, Mom had said. She isn't going to jail, is she? Mom said. Well, she's out on bail now, Jesus said. But in the end, I think there's a good chance she will, honey. Oh, fuck. I thought of Liz in an orange jumpsuit like the women in that Netflix show my mother sometimes watched. She took my hand. Right, right, right. 54. It was 2 or 3 weeks later when Liz kidnapped me. You could say she did that the first time with Terrio, but you could call that a soft snatch. This time was the real deal. She didn't force me into her car, kicking and screaming, but she still forced me, which makes it kidnapping as far as I'm concerned. I was on the tennis team and on my way home from a bunch of practice matches, which our coach called heats for some dumb reason. I had my pack on my back and my tennis duffel in one hand. I was headed for the bus stop and saw a woman leaning against a beat-up Toyota and looking at her phone. I walked past without a second glance. It never occurred to me that this scrawny chick, straw blonde hair blowing around the collar of an unzipped duffel coat, oversized gray sweatshirt, beat-up cowboy boots disappearing into baggy jeans, was my mom's old friend. My mom's old friend had favored tapered slacks in dark colors and low-cut silk blouses. My mom's old friend wore her hair slicked back and pulled into a short stump of ponytail. My mom's old friend had looked healthy.
Hey, champ, not even a how you doing for an old friend?
I stopped and turned back. For a moment, I still didn't recognize her. Her face was bony and pale. There were blemishes, untouched by makeup, dotting her forehead. All the curves I had admired in a little boy way, granted, were gone. The baggy sweatshirt beneath the coat showed only a hint of what had been generous breasts. At a guess, I'd say she was 40 or even 50 pounds lighter and looked 20 years older.
Liz? None other.
She gave me a smile, then obscured it by wiping her nose with the heel of her hand. Strung out, I thought. She's strung out.
How are you?
Maybe not the wisest question, but the only one I could think of under the circumstances.